I'm Welcome to Outthink. I'm Lawrence Akers, clinical hypnotherapist, member of the LGBT community, and a passionate advocate for mental health. Today, we are talking with David Clark, who is going to talk about his experience of being diagnosed as bipolar back in 2011, and talk about his journey helping to work through the diagnosis. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Hello.
So, I guess let's go back a bit. You were diagnosed back in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that point, did you have any inkling or any thought that you may have been bipolar?
No, simple answer to that. Complete surprise, although having read other people's memoirs who've been through the experience of a diagnosis of bipolar, there are clear signs, warning signs that the brain is dysfunctional or misfiring. So the biggest sign that I didn't realize until I did have the diagnosis and read other people's memoirs was brain snaps. And we don't even have that term in the UK. It's recognized here. So I had a brain snap when I was about 19 in the second year of my degree, lasting seconds, unexpected, embarrassing. Another brain snap in the second when I was 26 at an accountancy Viva. Another brain snap when I was 33, when I was in a meeting with my director and his boss about a management paper, and another brain snap in a Moscow airport because there was a problem with my visa, a problem with them letting me fly back from Moscow to London. The brain snaps are caused by intense stress, which the brain is unable to process, and it results in a verbal outburst.
Okay, so when you say a brain snap and a verbal outburst, you know, what does, for someone who is seeing someone having a brain snap, what does that actually look like?
Quite scary, because you're having a conversation with someone like I'm talking to you now, but then all of a sudden the person you're having the conversation with will just have a verbal outburst that will be loud, intense, aggressive, and then disappear. It's like a volcano exploding and then just going into complete calm, and it just lasts seconds. And as I said just earlier, they happened every 8 years. So I never really understood why these brain snaps occurred until I got the diagnosis of bipolar and then read people's memoirs, and these people with who'd written about their experience also had brain snaps.
And so when you were diagnosed with bipolar, what was your initial reaction to it? How did you process it or feel about it?
Jeez. Okay, so when I got the formal diagnosis, that was in September 2011. So my head would have been a complete mess. At this point, I'd just come out of a psychotic episode lasting 6 months. The psychotic episode was induced by work stress, and my brain went into a tailspin, upwards, downwards, sideways. In around March 2011, my employment was terminated in the job I was in. It was a high stress, high performing, high paid role, and I was never sectioned for 6 months. Somehow I managed to live, eat, function somehow. It was a very interesting experience. I write about it in my book. I went to see my GP 3 times. He never did anything whilst trying to prescribe me lithium. Of course, when you're psychotic, you don't think you're ill. You're just very pleased with life. I went a second time to see a different GP late May 2011. He referred me to a psychiatrist. That psychiatrist gave me Seroquel, low dose, and I took the Seroquel and came out of the psychosis May, June, July, August, September, mid-September. Walking down the street going, what's going on in my life? What's been going on the past few months? It's very weird.
How did your family and friends react with the diagnosis?
Lost all my friends. They disappeared, went, oh, you're not well.
That
so
must
they
have been
they all
really
went.
Really hard to
well, them. You know, when you're up there, you just kind of, you know, and it's just when you read people's memoirs, it's the story. You know, just everyone disappears because you're like, oh, you're not well. So, you know, I've reconnected with some of them and explained and everything, so that's all good. But it is intense. It's intense for the individual. It's intense for others around them. The family. They So my father passed away in 2004. So, you know, he was undiagnosed and his mood swings are incredible. So it's hereditary. Bipolar is hereditary. But my mother was in her latter years. So for her, it must have been really challenging listening to her son half around the world jabbering on like a twillip. And it was, you know, when somebody's psychotic, they jabber. They just talk without breathing, jabber, jabber, jabber. High energy, kind of coherent but incoherent. So it must have been hard for her. I did go see her in the latter years and explained everything. And she kind of understood it. And, you know, it is what it is. But I shouldn't have had to be psychotic for 6 months.
And so going through that experience, what at what point did you start to kind of rebuild, for want of a better term?
God.
Like, I mean, it's a hard question, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's not a hard question. No, I've had to tenaciously rebuild myself. So it's kind of like, what... where to from here? So when you're diagnosed at the age of 44 with the second most intense major mental illness, you kind of go, oh, well, what next? And the system is so dysfunctional, so counterintuitive, you have to take control of yourself. So as I mentioned in my memoir, you have to take control even when you're not in control. So I had to go see a second GP for a second assessment while I was psychotic. So that's how bad the system is. And never sectioned with a psychiatrist, he never sectioned me, even though he said I was clearly psychotic. So that's a bit of a question mark. He gave me the Seroquel got me out of psychosis. I had to, I was thrown out of my apartment because I wasn't paying the rent. I managed to find somewhere as a house share. I managed to rebuild my life. It's taken me 6 years. The system is stuffed, full stop.
And I know before we started recording, you were sharing with me some of the difficulties that you've experienced, both at a state and a federal level. And I think we absolutely agree on the fact, especially at a federal level, that there seems to be a complete
huge problem.
Lack of understanding or support for mental health services in this country.
Yeah, totally, totally. So, and it's especially interesting because the current federal minister's on record in The Age being interviewed when he was appointed that his mother went through the similar diagnosis. So I believe he's on a mission to help, but the system is so dysfunctional. I've had to feedback to my psychiatrist that he's not well. He asked me about a private meeting and what was discussed. That's unprofessional, inappropriate, unethical. He's accepted that. But why should I, as an individual, have to call my psychiatrist on his behaviour? And I've had to call my GP on his behaviour. But again, you know, it's just a reflection of the system. I've also had to call Centrelink because they made me unwell twice. Again, I'm an individual. Why should I have to call federal state systems on their unhelpful behaviour, culture, performance, whilst I'm helping myself get better?
This is a big question. I'll put it out there.
We love big questions.
What do you think needs to happen to help improve?
That is a big question.
Yeah, it is. It's almost a may or may not be able to answer
I can answer anything. It needs to be turned on its head. So we need more patient-centric services. Patients need to be heard and listened to. Clients need to be heard and listened to. The whole point of Centrelink is to help people regain health and well-being and get themselves into some form of paid employment. The way Centrelink is operating at the moment is totally counterproductive, counterintuitive. The whole system is wrong. It needs completely redesigning. So does the mental health system. They're trying to turn it on its head to start focusing on actually what individuals need, but it's so big. It's such a big task. The federal and state government have issued 10-year plans. State government are kind of making progress. Federal government have delegated to the primary healthcare networks. The timescales are tight. They're trying to make progress. There's money being pumped through the system, but it's so huge. The scale of mental illness is so huge. The challenge is so huge. And people are being dishwashered, is the way I describe it, especially through the NDIS, where yesterday I heard that people have to produce all the documentation all over again relating to their mental illness to get into the NDIS. Why, when all that information is in Centrelink already, and Centrelink and NDIS are federal government systems? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of double handling and a lot of additional stress for people who really don't need that stress.
For people who can't even get out of the morning when they're depressed,
yeah,
are going to have to deal with an NDIS system that is trying to help but is requiring so much detail, so much information, reports from psychiatrists, GPs, that those people have already provided to Centrelink? Really?
Mm. Yeah, it definitely feels like there's it's something of an afterthought. And in some ways, I can't blame people for feeling that the government is intentionally making it incredibly difficult for people to be able to utilise these services effectively.
I really question what they're up to. Intention is a big word. I prefer the word ethically. If you're ethically trying to help people get better, take the stress off them, redesign the service around them, not on top of them, focus on helping them, not training them.
Mm. Going back a little bit, for those people that are listening that may not know what bipolar is, I guess it'd be interesting to get a little bit of a definition, because I know for a lot of people there's almost this stereotypical view of what bipolar is, and almost being that split personality thing, which, you know, you see. I remember back in the 80s there was a Country Practice on here, and one of the characters in it suffered bipolar and was displaying very bizarre behavior. Yeah. Ironic twist, the actor who played that, Miles Buchanan, did go on to actually have bipolar.
I'm quite careful with language. So you don't suffer bipolar, it's an experience. It's not an identity either. So I run a meetup group for people diagnosed with bipolar mood disorder, and they say, I am bipolar. I say, well, are you actually bipolar, or is it a diagnosis? I argue it's a diagnosis. It's a moment in time, a reflection of your brain chemistry, because bipolar is explained through a missing brain chemical, that most people diagnosed with bipolar are high performing. However, are missing a certain brain chemical that results in the brain spinning out if it's unable to deal with a lot of stress through being bombarded with a lot of information, that it just tips into either psychosis or depression. So the person either spins into mania or to depression, depending on what the issue is that their brain is being pushed out against. So with the mania stress, I was being overloaded with information. My brain was trying to find solutions to multiple problems across multiple projects. With the depressions that I experienced, it was related again to work. You can tell where I'm going with my mission in life coaching. Depressions were caused because I was associating my whole identity and self-worth to the job I was doing. And I was having difficulty, because I'd emigrated from UK to Australia, finding the right job, getting interviews but not getting the jobs, and just feeling lack of self-worth, spinning into depression. And the depressions I've never had before in my life until I came to Australia are really horrible. You disassociate, you become an animal in a cage, and I can recall some of the experiences were really bad.
Yeah.
Never again.
I think the distinction you made there about identity in relation to diagnosis is such a valuable one for people to take on board. You know, you see people coming in here even saying, no, I am anxious, I am depressed, and I agree, you need to stop and go, well, actually, no, you are experiencing that in this moment. You may not always experience that.
Correct.
You certainly are not that. You're as much that as a smoker is a smoker.
But this is the power of language. You know, we don't realize how powerful language is, because it actually is more powerful than we realize, because it actually influences our identity, our thoughts, language, behavior. And if we're not consciously aware of what we're saying, doing, the way we're living, how do we realize that the results which we're experiencing in life, we are totally accountable for?
In terms of what you did to start improving on yourself, or to take that new direction, and I get a very strong sense that it's aligned with a passion and a direction where you're going. How did that start? What did you discover?
Oh, goodness me, good questions. So, ironically, whilst I was psychotic, I read What Colour Is Your Parachute? Which is a well bestseller, well-recognized book on people who are going, what do I want to do with my life? From reading that book, I decided a life coach would be a good path to take. I was psychotic when I read that book and made that decision. I was psychotic when I did the intake weekend for the coaching course. Nobody realized I was just talking a lot. I used to train people, so I do talk a lot, but most of what I say when I'm well makes sense. When I'm psychotic, it makes no sense whatsoever. And when I'm depressed, I say nothing because I'm depressed and it's not very good to be in. When I got well again-ish, I pursued the diploma, finished the diploma, felt empowered because of what life coaching talks about: self-empowerment, taking control, recovering, balance, being calm, being happy, la la. It all made sense to me. So my brain followed on. Following down that further, learning about mbraining.com, head, heart, gut, three brains, going, actually, if my brain's misfiring, I can get out of my brain into my body. Connect with my feelings, connect with my intuition, and that has guided me. My intuition, especially, my gut instinct, has saved me totally. However, that has also resulted in me being on a bit of a mission because of what we said earlier about the system, federal and state, being so flawed. So it'll be interesting where it goes. I'm not quite clear, but I do have a clear mission to help transform the lack of connection with patient-centric service delivery, which is totally not value for money. So many billions are spent on mental health provision, and it's not delivering.
You think that would have some sort of ability to audit or watch the success of what they're doing to determine if the benchmarks are being hit. And I can see you almost falling off your chair in a fit of laughter there at that whole suggestion. Are you laughing because you believe this is obvious?
I have been through the Australian National Audit Office website to look at what they've done on Centrelink, and they did a whole series of reports about 20 years ago, 10 years ago. They've done nothing since. Something's going on there. State government have tried to audit mental health in Victoria, didn't really get mental health services. It's a very complex service to audit. However, now the state government has a mental health plan that says it's going to report annually. Let's hope the state audit office audits state government to track progress in implementing the plan. The state plan is vague, it's non-specific. It does talk about human rights. It does talk about the problem. It kind of talks about the solution, but it's not really very good. And then there's the NDIS, which is going to totally transform the way mental health services deliver and is going to cause, I really hope not, but more problems than it solves.
Right. And this is a shame because, we have the World Health Organization highlighting that depression is going to be one of the
Correct.
biggest killers
Correct.
out there.
Correct.
Even if we look at things like mental health in the workplace associated to bullying, it costs the Australian economy something like $200 billion a year. It's estimated that 50% of all Australian workers are going to experience bullying during some point in their career and the mental health issues that are associated with that. We are talking about something that really needs to have far greater focus and energy and commitment put towards it. Yet we seem to be, I don't know if it's because, if you sprain or you fall over and hurt your hand, for instance, people can look at your hand and go, wow, that looks really sore. You should be resting it up and stop what you're doing. Whereas if you were to call in unwell at work and say, I'm calling in unwell, I'm struggling with depression, the response will generally be something along the lines of, look, suck it up and get in here. It's all in your head.
Suck it up, princess.
Yeah.
Look, this is the biggie. This really is the biggie, and this is where deep scale transformational cultural change will happen, because the way the world is turning, especially this year, people are really walking away from politics. Politicians. What will happen next federal election will be interesting. It'll be interesting to see the result in 2 weeks' time, the UK election. especially with what's happening there, and with the USA as well. People are really fed up with politicians not listening, not acting. And with regard to the bullying, there's some big work to be done there. Politics is full of bullies. There are some politicians that could be argued are bullies. Really, they're supposed to be serving the public. They are elected to serve. I question whether politicians are all serving. Some are. Some clearly are. Some really aren't. I think
it has moved more towards self-serving in a lot of cases.
I don't want to get too personal, but it needs to change.
Yeah, a lot of them bringing their own ideologies into politics, you know, especially if we look at the likes of Cory Bernardi and the ultra-conservative side of things there. The impact that he is going to have on the mental health of LGBT people,
look,
single-handedly is almost disturbing.
Well, you've got to understand politicians. So the politicians, some are deeply unwell, deeply disassociated. Politics is a very fascinating for me field because of the connection of politicians between themselves and the people they serve. The degree to which they listen and act to meet the needs of the people they serve.
I think it also comes down to how authentic they actually
exactly,
are.
Exactly, exactly.
If we look at
really
someone like Macron in
oh,
France,
my God, that man is going to be fascinating.
How much do we love him already?
Well,
because it feels real.
But you've got to understand as well, there are some fascinating people. The way he's dealing with Trump, you know, the handshake, the way he dealt with the G7 and went to Merkel and then the others and then Trump last. And now he's gone to Putin. So it will take time. The young generation have had enough.
Yeah.
They will transform the way politics is delivered, even in the Age Today about marriage equality and all that sort of stuff. It will change. But those that don't listen and act will be requested to leave. So the next election will be interesting because there will be a lot of people who will lose their seats.
Absolutely. Changing tact again. You've written a book, WTF, Life is Not Always What It Seems, which I believe is available on Amazon.
Correct.
Tell me a little bit about the creation of this book. How did this book come about, and was it something that you found to be quite therapeutic in a sense?
Yeah, it's very interesting because I you know, one of those things you sort of through your life you go, oh, I'd really like to write, I'd like to be published, and you never get around to it, and then all of a sudden you have a major mental illness and you get through it and you navigate it and you go, this is chaos, what do I do with it? And you go, write a book and release it. So in the book I talk about my life story, growing up in a country village, moving into the town, through teenage years, all the challenges of growing up as a teenager, grappling with my sexuality, so I didn't come out until I was 26. Oh my goodness, that was the biggest challenge ever. Dealing with a dysfunctional, angry father who apparently beat up his wife, blah blah blah. Talk about the psychosis. So there's a whole chapter of my psychotic writings, which are quite interesting. My experience with the mental health system, again, dysfunctional. When you've got a dysfunctional brain, not helpful. It's all in the book. And then the journey there on in. So I talk about how I recovered from the psychosis and depression. I talk about the depression after the psychosis, the medication that I went on that I've now got off, the fact that I've lost a lot of weight through using a naturopath and acupuncture, and into the last chapter of how I've calmed down my dysfunctional bipolar brain. And I refer to my bipolar brain, the fact that we can rewire our neurology, neurochemistry, if we so choose.
And that's the thing, looking through the book before, seeing that there's, you know, examples in there on NLP, neuroplasticity, all these really exciting movements forward in psychology,
amazing,
mental health, neuroplasticity being, I guess, one of the big buzzwords in more recent times. And obviously, every person is different. Every person is going to respond to different approaches and different techniques in very different ways. What techniques did you find personally resonated with you and made the biggest change?
So the biggest change is story. What's the story? Mm-hmm. And connection and purpose. And it's, you know, it's even been interesting the last few weeks and months because I have just been dealing with so many issues. My apartment got flooded due to a leak in the upstairs apartment. All chaos there, dealt with that. Dealing with a Centrelink dysfunctional approach that I dealt with through my federal MP, dealing with a psychiatrist that's asking me about private conversation and wanting to know what was discussed, calling that. Just dealing with so many issues and then dealing with myself and going, why am I procrastinating getting back into paid employment? Because I was coaching sort of, but I was sort of faffing myself around. And what it was because the psychosis that I experienced in 2011 was work-related. So then I had to unpack all that in myself to release all the stress and nonsense, anxiety within myself that I was aware of because I've got the toolkit to understand myself and what's going on with me. That has been the biggest challenge. That, because of the lived experience I've had with bipolar, nobody medically qualified could understand because they haven't been through the journey. Anybody who's been through the journey can understand the journey and the nature of the challenge in dealing with self when self is flawed.
Mm. And I have no doubt that as a coach, you work with a wide, diverse variety of people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you find, though, that you also attract people who have been through a similar journey yourself?
Correct.
And you know, what kind of insights have they had from working with you?
So the insights they have, I mean, even we had a meetup on Saturday, is self-worth is the biggest challenge.
Mm.
Because if you lose everything, if you lose your sanity, if you lose your identity, so you lose your sanity through mania, psychosis, and you lose your identity through depression because you just become worthless, you know, who are you? What are you? What can you achieve in your life if you go through what I call a dishwasher experience with your head? What, you know, and there's nobody out there, unless you connect with somebody with lived experience, which I've been able to through memoirs and actually listening to people who've been through experience, realizing that actually I can recover.
Yeah.
I can heal myself and reconfigure myself to create meaning in my life. And that's where I'm at and that's where I'm going. So it's just having hope and people that inspire you to go, I can do this.
Is that one of the biggest challenges with people that have gone through what you have, that sense of hopelessness?
Yeah, because there's, you know, Stephen Fry has been a massive leader in addressing mental health stigma. You know, just sharing a story, sharing experience, being authentic, being a person who is happy, fun, did QI, totally out there, going, doing the manic depressive, you know, stories with BBC, and it's all online, YouTube and everything, you know, and just sharing, saying, this is what I went through. I went to Africa and did this documentary and was suddenly slipped into a psychotic episode and had to ring my psychiatrist, and my psychiatrist said, you're not well, come back, we'll help you out, and just, you need to slow down. And he's stepped down from QI now, Sandy Toksvig's doing it, and he's just, you know, but you do need someone who you can trust to be able to call and saying, I don't think I'm well. Am I unwell? Yes, you are. Sort yourself out.
What do you do to help manage your state of mind to know that, you know, if you can feel something coming on that you need to take that step back? How do you manage that now?
Delegate. Upwards, backwards, downwards, sideways. So when I talk about the nonsense of Centrelink and mental health system, I went through my federal MP and my state MP, because when something is so hard, it shouldn't be. It should be there to help you, and it's not. You just go, enough. Delegate. You're elected to help me. You're elected to help me. Help me. And they did. So good on them. But the system is so dysfunctional, and it shouldn't be.
Tell us a little bit about what it is that you provide for your coaching. How can people get in touch with you if they want to?
So my website's Calmer Coaching, C-A-L-M-E-R, coaching.com. Dave Marty Virgo on Facebook. My Facebook page is Lime Green Solutions. I post a lot of stuff on there. If anybody wants to contact me, 0413-508-306. I obviously, I guess, have a bucket of experience and skills and ability if I can recover from psychosis and depression
to where I'm at now, which I believe is a pretty good state of mind and health. Lost 12 kilos. My naturopath says that my gaydar age is 42. I'm 50 this year, which is not bad.
That's great.
Yeah, I think I'm in a pretty good place. Happy to help others in any way.
What does the future have in store for David Clark?
Sorry about that. That's really funny. Well, I don't know, because I was invited to join the National Audit Office Value for Money Development Team as a newbie. That team trains people to do value for money work, from senior management to newbies. So I was very anxious when I joined the team. I was like, whoa, I'm going from small scale work on audits published to Parliament to huge scale training, both internally, 200 people, senior management liaising, and also internationally. I'm being expected to deliver. So I went through a bucket load of self-worth anxiety. I was such a mess for about 6 months because nobody told me what my job really was. I was given tasks to do. I just went through so many self-confidence issues. It's unreal. I navigated through them. I rose to head up the team, resulted in me training in Denmark, Hungary, Romania, Turkey, Northern Turkish Republic of Cyprus, and ultimately in Moscow, Russia. That was the icing on the cake. Never could anyone have told me you'll be working in Moscow. I did. It was a total success. At that point, I thought, wow, cool. Can't go anywhere further. Emigrated to Australia.
Long story there by the sounds.
Well, it is, but it's kind of like the way you get over yourself and your self-judgment and your self-worth is by just going, do what you can. Yep. Enjoy life. This could go anywhere. You really, if you push yourself over your anxiety and self-worth and lack of confidence, can have a most amazing life. And, you know, my half-sister has read my memoir and goes, geez, you are a total overperformer. That book is an incredible journey. And look at you. You know, you're just quite something. You're the black sheep of the family. I kind of always have been. What are we related? And of course we are related. My father was a bit of a overachiever, but just grumbly fart. I am not a grumbly fart, but always will be an overachiever. And it's kind of just me.
It is funny, though, hearing what you said there, because one of the reoccurring messages with the clients I've been working with over the past few days, and it seems to be the universe telling me this, is to get out of the way of myself.
Totally. Okay, so one of the guys at the meetup on Saturday is an artist, but he was so self-judging. Oh, nobody's going to buy my art. Nobody wants to see my art. Nobody really likes my art. I really don't. You know, I want to do some stuff, but... And I said, okay, there are all these millionaires in Melbourne and Victoria and Australia and around the world. All these millionaires with big apartments, big houses, big blank walls going, I need some art. Bloody hell, where do I go for art? There's a guy out there somewhere who would produce the art I need. I have bucket loads of money in my bank account. I want to give him money for his art, but he just won't create any art because he's sitting in his studio going, I'm not good enough. Well, how about you actually do some stuff, put it on show, and then that individual will go fill their walls with your art and give you a bucket loads of money quite easily. And he went, never thought about it like that. Oh, God, I'm going to start creating art.
It is ironic, though, that, you know, people come into you and say, I feel stuck. I feel stuck. I can't move.
That's the key issue.
But then they turn around and say, oh, but I can't do that because no one will like it. And it's like, well, we know now why you're stuck. You're stuck because you're in your own way.
Yeah.
So here's an idea. Tell yourself to shut up and move out the way and get on with doing what it is that you feel that you want to do.
Correct. And that's where we are in 2017, that the more people get out their own way and get rid of self-judgment and trust their gut instinct, trust their mission, purpose, value that they can add in the world, and the more likely they are to enjoy a calm, happy, flowing daily life.
Exactly. Now, we will put links up on our website at Release Hypnosis for where people can purchase your book. We'll also put all the contact details that you have said earlier as well, in case people wish to get in touch with you and experience some coaching or some work with you. But I want to thank you so much for your time today to come in and to share so openly your experience of what it was like to go through everything you've gone through and to get out the other end and to find that there's so much self-worth there self-acceptance, and I'd say a bright, exciting future ahead.
Thank you very much.
And for everyone else, thanks for listening, and we shall look forward to you joining us in the next fortnight. Until then, please stay safe.